I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. With the success of his memoir Jarhead, author Anthony Swofford found fame and fortune, but in the ensuing years he went through a lot of cash, and women and drugs too, all the while striving to reconcile his relationship with his father. Swofford emerged from that time with a new memoir. On today's program, we talk with the author about that time in his life, how he went from owning a Manhattan apartment to renting a cabin in the Catskills, from traveling around the world at will to taking road trips in his dad's Winnebago, and from rage to understanding. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Obama will address reporters at the White House shortly about his renewed campaign to extend Bush-era tax cuts for the middle class. He'll call on Congress to pass a one-year extension for households making under $250,000. His Republican presidential rival Mitt Romney has said he wants the tax cuts extended for all income earners, including wealthier Americans. Romney's campaign announced it raised $106 million in the month of June, outraising President Obama by a wide margin. NPR's Esvi Date reports the figure sets a new record for Republican presidential candidates.
The total for the various Romney fundraising committees was half again more than the $71 million Mr. Obama's committees raised. Full details are not yet available for either campaign and likely will not be for another 2 weeks. But even the summary numbers suggest that Governor Romney has been able to wipe out Mr. Obama's cash-on-hand advantage, despite spending tens of millions of dollars and several months fighting off rivals in a series of GOP primaries. In September of 2008, then-candidate Obama took in $150 million, which remains the monthly record for presidential fundraising. Esvi Date, NPR News.
There appears to be a new agreement on a path to ending the Syrian violence. International envoy Kofi Annan says he and President Bashar al-Assad have agreed on an approach.
They reassured me of the government's commitment to the six-point plan, which, of course, we should move ahead to implement in a much better fashion than has been the situation so far.
Annan has been struggling to salvage a peace effort that has been largely ignored by Syria's troops and rebels. Norway may shut down oil exports within hours if the government does not intervene in a 16-day labor dispute over pensions. Terry Schultz reports a strike has rattled oil markets and is pushing AP price of Brent crude.
Offshore oil workers are demanding full pension for retiring at age 62, 5 years earlier than Norway's national retirement age. Norwegian oil companies refuse on the grounds that working just 16 weeks per year is already a good deal. If the government doesn't order an end to the strike today, which it's shown no intention of doing, the industry says it will lock out employees at midnight, ceasing production. Norway is Western Europe's largest oil producer, pumping out some 2 million barrels per day. Production's already declined during the dispute. State-controlled Statoil, the market leader, says it won't wait to see if the government does take action and is beginning a shutdown. A spokesman says the company will claim force majeure, circumstances beyond its control, for its failure to honor contracts. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow is down 82 points. This is NPR News. Seven-time Tour de France champion Lance Armstrong is suing to block doping charges against him. Attorneys for the cycling athlete argue the U.S. anti-doping agency is violating Armstrong's constitutional rights. Armstrong denies using performance-enhancing drugs during his career. He has until Saturday to accept the anti-doping agency's sanctions or send the case to arbitration. If found guilty, Armstrong could be stripped of his Tour de France victories and be banned from competition for life. A couple of new studies are casting more doubt on a 2010 report that stated some bacteria are able to survive on arsenic. NPR's John Hamilton reports that would break a fundamental rule of life.
In December 2010, a team of researchers published evidence that a bacterium from California's Mono Lake was able to use the element arsenic in its DNA instead of phosphorus.
The claim made headlines because arsenic, in addition to being a poison, isn't one of the six essential elements thought to be used by all forms of life on Earth. 6 months later, a number of prominent scientists published papers challenging the claim, and now the journal Science, where the initial paper appeared, is publishing two papers online that appear to end the controversy. One of the papers found that the bacterium's DNA does not contain arsenic. The other found that samples of growth medium from the initial study contained enough phosphorus to support life. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Myanmar's pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi is taking part in her first parliamentary session since her historic swearing-in last May. Suu Kyi was elected to office after a decades-old fight for democratic reform. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of public radio listeners all across America who support their NPR member stations.
Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. The travails of life as a soldier in wartime are well documented in books and film, but rarely so vividly or powerfully as by Anthony Swofford in his instant classic Jarhead about his life as a Marine in the First Gulf War. The book, with its gritty, literary, raw and poetic writing, was an immediate success, becoming not just a bestseller itself, but the basis of the movie starring Jake Gyllenhaal. But there's something else as persistently real as the war experience, also well documented, but less celebrated, and that's what happens afterward. And in the years after his own admittedly unusual experience, one filled with the rewards of literary success, Anthony Swofford's life took a downward turn. The headline on one review of his new book called it Post-Traumatic Success Disorder. Anthony Swofford joins us today from NPR in New York City. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
It's nice to have you with us. So your new memoir is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, and you actually start this book after the publication of your last book. But I want to step back to before that. Take us back to the 1990s after you returned home from war, because that sort of lays the groundwork for what will happen later. Where were you in your life then? How were you dealing with being home, with the post-war experience?
Yeah. It was a difficult transition for me, like many combat veterans that I know, friends of mine. Coming back to the real world after combat was difficult. I had trouble just finding solid footing. And I'd been in the Marine Corps for 4 years during extremely formative years from 18 to 22, and from the age of 18 to 22, and I'd gone to combat. And I could always trust what was going to happen in the Marine Corps. I could, even if I didn't like a fellow Marine, I could trust him. I knew he'd been trained. I knew what was expected of him and what was expected of me. And that's just not true out in the civilian world. And I found myself kind of skulking around college campuses for a few years and really being kind of lost and confused and trying to find some meaning, through education and trying to make sense of what my combat experience and my Marine Corps experience would mean to me in the years forward.
Mm-hmm. Did you work during that time?
I did. I held different jobs. You know, worked in a mall for a couple of months. Worked in a bank. Worked for many years as a forklift driver in a warehouse. And I realized later that I was self isolating during that job. It was a job that was very lonely. It was an ice. It was the freezer unit in this massive warehouse, and I could work for 8 or 10 hours and not really talk to other people. And I realized that I did something that I know other veterans do as well, and that is self isolate. Mm-hmm. And spend time alone rather than socializing and becoming part of community,
which stands in such sharp contrast to the life where you share almost every moment of every day with other people.
Right, right. It's a different kind of lifestyle, and I think in the long term, what I realized is that I was trying to escape my history as a Marine. I was trying to I wanted to be a student. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to live a radically different life. And I thought I could just forget it. But it took the writing of my first book, Jarhead, which I started writing 10 years almost exactly to the date that at the 10-year anniversary of the end of the first Gulf War. And I had to write that book. That had to be my first book. I had to reopen that experience and tell that story because my story hadn't been told. And I felt like at the time that the Marine Corps story, and specifically the Marine Corps story during the 1991 Gulf War, was untold.
Would you say that prior to the writing of the book, that were you suffering from what today we now have come to call post-traumatic stress disorder? Were you suffering the way other veterans have with that?
You know, I refrain from self-diagnosing, but I think I had a hint of combat trauma and some psychological impairments that were a result of combat and having been in the Marine Corps. And I had trouble finding solid ground, and psychologically solid ground was kind of difficult. The Marine Corps is ends up being a safe place when you know what's expected of you and others, and that wasn't true back in the world. I took a lot of risks. I did something that over the years I've discovered in other combat veterans, and in fact in my father, who's a Vietnam veteran, and much of this new book is also about my relationship with my father and his history as a veteran. But I took a lot of risks. I drove cars very quickly and dangerously. I used substances. I lied to people I was in relationships with, because after you've come back from war, there's this I call it this wickedly exhausting sensation, and that is that I've lived. Mm-hmm. You come back, you're alive. You could have died. You walk into war expecting to die, and you come home, and it's very exciting that you're alive. And the consequences then of the life that you live seem minor compared to what were the possible consequences mm-hmm. of combat. And that can sometimes, wreak a lot of havoc in someone's life. And it wreaked some havoc in mine. And before me, it wreaked havoc in my father's life. And I grew up, I would call myself a war baby. I was conceived when my father was on R&R from Vietnam in Honolulu. My mother had met him there. And my father's history as a combatant really colored and contorted my own childhood.
Well, I do want to talk more about your father and about the effort to reconcile with him later that you tell in the story of in this book. I have to think, though, that moment of publishing Jarhead transforms your experience as a post-war veteran, that in addition to whatever else you may have been dealing with, now you have this sudden influx of fame and of money. That's where your story becomes an atypical story, right?
Yeah, unlike a lot of veterans, I had an excess of funds and I had time on my hands. I had published a book and I could live how and where I wanted. And I was an ex-Marine in my 30s living in Manhattan, and I was living life at full speed. And
you're an ex-Marine sales. Whose life had been portrayed by Jake Gyllenhaal on film for everybody.
Yeah, sure. My abs are much tighter than Jake's.
I'm sure that's right.
But he did a pretty fine job of portraying me. I liked the adaptation of that book was a very fine adaptation. I was lucky that very talented people were a part of the process from the beginning to the end. And sure, it was a little discombobulating. I had been a guy alone in a room writing a book for a year, writing the very best book that I possibly could. And, for 2.5, maybe 3 years later, there it was on screen. And, some actor was being called my name and living this life that was, somewhat mine.
Yeah.
And that was strange.
Yeah. I wonder, you talked about these years you spent skulking around college campuses and sort of learning the craft of writing. Did you get through these years sort of really imagining the day that you would be a literary success? I mean, most writers have this bit of realism in them, knowing that most don't make it, most don't have that big moment. Did you see a way forward from forklift driver and student to this life you were about to embark on of wealth and fame?
No, I didn't see that. I knew that I would write the best books that I possibly could, and that I would work very hard at it. And I gave myself until I was in my 40s. I figured I'd be typing away in a dark, dank basement somewhere, trying to find a publisher, like, you know, happens for most writers. But I also knew that I believed in myself. I believed in writing. I believed in it as a way of life. I believed in it as something very important and essential in terms of culture, but also in terms of who I was and what kind of person I was going to be in the world, what kind of citizen I was going to be. I knew I was at my very best when I was sitting alone making words happen on the page. And so I always believed in that. I didn't really... Sure, you know, every writer wants to be read first. You want a readership, and I was extremely lucky that my first book, you know, found me a readership.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking today with Anthony Swofford, who's the author both of Jarhead and his new memoir, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. Anthony, in your new book, you talk about your relationship with your father a great deal. It's really the centerpiece of the book. And I wonder if you could just sort of tell us a little bit of his story. Who was your dad?
Yeah, my father was a Southerner. He'd grown up in West Georgia, pretty poor. And he suffered what I think is probably the very worst wound, and that is when he was a month old, his mother died of complications from childbirth. And so he grew up and then shortly after that, his father went off to World War II. And so he then, you know, grew up as the stepchild, and there was a large family. And it was really kind of Southern Baptist Gothic, the way he grew up in the woods of West Georgia. And he escaped at 17. He joined the Air Force because he wanted to get out of there and live a different life, something that I would do myself many years later. But so there's a real kind of tragedy and darkness that follows my father. He went off to Vietnam. He was 28. He had two kids. And, you know, like many men at Vietnam, he saw some dark, heinous, tragic things at combat. And he came home, and, you know, then I came into the world. And, you know, my mother tells me that he changed radically after Vietnam, that he began to disengage from the family, and his moods were darker. And my father never sought help. You know, when I was a teenager, he once kind of bragged to me. He'd been out of the military now for 4 or 5 years. And I can't remember what the context of the conversation was, but we were talking about, you know, therapy. And he bragged to me that when we lived in Tokyo, he'd been told by his commander to go see the base psychiatrist, and that somehow he dodged that appointment and had never had to sit in the chair with a shrink. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, wow, Dad, if you'd sat in that chair with that shrink, maybe things would have been a little different at home. And so yeah. The darkness that my father experienced in the jungles of Vietnam, like many war veterans, he brought that stuff home, and it affected our household.
It was not a pleasant growing up, you to say the least.
Yeah, it was dark. My father was verbally and sometimes physically abusive, and he ran our home, you know, like we were a unit, like a small fire team. And the thing that became very confusing for me as a kid, I realize now, is that there was no consistency. So essentially there were two homes that I lived in, and there was one home when my father was gone, was at work or out of the house, and it was full of lightness and laughter, and that was the home that my mother controlled. And then when my father came home, things changed radically. We had to be quiet. We couldn't upset our father. We had to, you know, make sure that everything was in perfect order for him. Otherwise, you know, bad things would happen. Mm-hmm. And that was confusing to me as a kid.
Right. And there was also the sort of he was two-faced, though. He could turn on the charm and be something different, right?
He could, he's a Southern guy. He's a storyteller. He's a charmer. Growing up, my kids loved my dad. They'd come over, and he had this beautiful, deep Georgia drawl, and friends loved hearing his stories. And but then he could blow up on his children, and then a few hours later, take me into his lap and say, "Hey, son, I'm really sorry. I'm sorry I acted that way. It's not the kind of father I want to be." And this confused me greatly.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. If you are a fan of the writing of Anthony Swofford, either Jarhead or the new book, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at updatedate@kcur.org. You're also welcome to go to the KCUR Facebook page or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Especially interested in hearing from veterans today. Anthony Swofford, a veteran, about his relationship with his father, also a veteran. What are the effects that war or military service had on your life and your relationship? In any case, call us at 235-2888. In the memoir, you focus on sort of the desire to be reconciled with your father. Much later, after a lot of water has gone under the bridge, how did you and your father come to be estranged?
Well, as a man in my late 20s and early 30s, I came to realize that I was really unhappy with the kind of parenting he'd done, and then something really awful happened, and my older brother died of cancer at the age of 35. And my father's behavior around my brother's sickness and his eventual death, I found really offensive and cowardly. He only visited my brother once during the year that he was sick. And then my father didn't attend my brother's funeral. And so I was there at the funeral in Georgia, and we have a massive family. So there were, over 100 family members there, and everyone was there except my father. And people kept asking me, "Where's your father, Tony? Where's John Howard? Where is he?" And I had no answer. I assumed that he was home alone in California, probably getting drunk and very angry at the world that his firstborn son had died. And I couldn't forgive him this. It haunted me. I would think, well, what happens if I die? What if I get hit by a bus tomorrow? Is my father not going to show up for my funeral? Mm. And why? Why wasn't he there? And my father never gave me acceptable answers. And that was really the core of the discord between us, was his not attending my brother's funeral.
Hmm. Had your father been proud of you for going into the Marines?
Yeah, my dad, he'd been in Vietnam. And right. The first time I invited a Marine Corps recruiter over to the house, he escorted the guy out of the house. Hmm. My dad didn't want me to join the Marines. He'd seen combat. He'd seen what happens to bodies at combat. I think he knew very well what can happen to someone's mind at combat. And he didn't want that for me. But eventually, I think he was proud that he had a son who'd been in the Marine Corps, who'd trained as a sniper, who'd gone to war. He liked that I had served our country just as he had. He found service to the country very important. But that was in my early 20s. And so, later these shifts occurred, and we had a lot of trouble being in the same room and getting along.
He didn't think much of your decision to be a writer afterward.
Yeah, not really. I mean, he didn't know what it really meant to be a writer. I mean, he was a working class guy, and on his mother's side, there were a few professors and some lawyers over the years, but no one in his immediate family. And I think it just confused him. He didn't know, what it meant to say when I said, "Hey, Dad, I'm working on a book." Mm-hmm. I think parents are often confused when their parents say, when their children say, "I want to be a writer, I want to be an artist, I want to be a musician." It doesn't always make sense, I'm sure. And it didn't make a lot of sense to my father. He didn't know how someone would make a living that way. And in the end, I just think he couldn't grasp what what the life would mean.
So skipping back then to the other part of your narrative, what that life did mean for you, which was success and money and fame, when it all starts to happen, when you become a well-known personality, when you move to New York City, are you happy at that point? I guess we're talking 2003, 2004.
Yeah, I was happy. I was very happy with my book. I was, I wrote a book that I believed in, and the book received attention, and I had readers, and I talked about the book extensively, and I saw that my book affected people. I knew that, and that was the most satisfaction and the most reward for my years of work and toil on the book. But I was, like I said earlier, I was running my life at full throttle. I was going through lovers, and I was going through money, and I was behaving. I think I was a little guilty about the success. You know, I was just another jarhead, really. But I had the fortune of writing the book, and writing a book about war that became the book that people read and the book that people talked about. And I became defined as this guy who wrote this book, Jarhead. I was that guy. I was called Jarhead by people. And, ironically, for, someone who wrote a memoir, I wanted to live a very private and quiet life. And then that wasn't completely possible. And I became very much defined by that book.
Yeah. Well, and what you're describing is almost a sense of guilt that your story became the story when there were so many other stories.
Yeah, there was certainly some guilt there, and also like a sense like, oh, do I deserve this? Or why do I deserve this? What does it really mean? It's one book. I must write other books. I have to be alone again in a room working, and just kind of wanting to, to obliterate myself while I was, obliterating the rewards of that success.
Mm-hmm. And without getting into too many of the details that might be inappropriate for public radio, your memoir, this new book, has a great deal of detail about the ways that you you blew the money on sex and drugs and I guess all manner of destructive self behaviors. What happened? I mean, why did that happen?
It happened because I landed in New York City in my early 30s, and I fell in love with a kind of volatile woman who urged me to move here, and I had money and I had time on my hands, and she moved with a crowd that partied a lot in the style of people partying in Manhattan, and I dropped into the lifestyle. It was much easier to go out to dinner 5 or 6 nights a week and, spend a couple $100 on dinner and on wine and on drugs. And it was easier to waste those days and those weeks and what became months than it was to work. I started living this life that was much more exciting than anything that I was working on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was much easier. The hardest thing is to sit alone in a room for months and years and pay close attention to what kind of book and what kind of art one is making. And it was much easier to waste that time and waste that money and really, waste a few years of my life.
There's a scene, one of probably several scenes that could be held up as typical, where you're on a beach in Malibu and you're with a woman that you've just met that evening. You're both drunk and a cop stops and questions you, and you lie about what you're doing there, almost, and he didn't push the issue. But you write in the book that you wish he had pushed the issue. You say, Ava and I wouldn't have gone back to my hotel room and been unfaithful to our partners, and I wouldn't have changed the course of my life for the next many years. Are you saying that you felt that you weren't really in control of your own life at that point? Or are you feeling like you almost couldn't have made responsible choices?
I think I could have used some help in making responsible choices.
Okay.
At the time, there were two routes I could have taken right there, and one was I was dating a woman who was a writer, well grounded, a couple years older than me, who wanted to settle down and live a quiet life on an island in BC. And then I met this woman who was a few years younger than me, who lived in New York City and who was kind of wild and out of control. And, you know, I went toward the torch. I went toward the blinding light because I thought that, well, I guess I thought I'd have more fun there. I thought that, and I also realized that I, you know, that that light would someday explode and explode me with it. And I was after that. I was after that intense and that intense experience.
Yeah, but the intense experience, you say, could have been prevented were it for the intervention of others.
Sure. Yeah, but I was doing, I was doing something then that I had done when I got out of the Marine Corps, which was kind of self-isolating. The people who, the friends who I probably could have used their advice at that point. I think I'd stopped returning their phone calls, and I was alone, and I wanted this aloneness. I wanted to make these decisions. I wanted to go toward this thing that was dangerous. And I was, in many ways, after the same kind of excitement and the same kind of thrill and the same kind of danger that combat had once offered me and that nothing else had. It's one thing that I also realized, you know, since Jarhead came out, I spent a lot of time around combat veterans, sitting around hearing their stories. And I know that something that I share with a lot of them is just that seeking out that danger again, because it's a thrill, it's an exhilaration, it's a kind of an adrenaline combat is that just doesn't happen back in the world. You come home, you look around, and life is kind of boring, and most people end up being kind of boring. And so if something grabs you, and it, even though it's dangerous, you're still gonna take that ride, and that's what I was after at that point. At the age of 33, I was still after that thing that I'd tasted at the age of 20 in the Arabian Desert.
Well, we're going to talk more with Anthony Swofford, author of his new book Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, also the author of his earlier memoir Jarhead, about this life that he lived after he became wealthy and famous, and especially about how, in the years since, he has sought to restore his relationship with his father and about the journey that they took together toward reconciliation. We want you to join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. If you are a veteran of combat, or maybe a parent or a child have been, how have the effects of war changed your life? And if you're not a veteran, how has this story, how has hearing about those who have struggled to come back from war and adjust to life in society had an impact on your life? You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. And welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in today for Steve Kraske. If you missed our talk on Friday with the independent foreign and documentary film critics, you can find their recommendations and all our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Be sure to join Steve Kraske tomorrow on the program. The All-Star Game is back in Kansas City, and we'll have an inside look. So join us at 11 tomorrow here on KCUR. Today we're talking with Anthony Swofford. He's the author of Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a new memoir about his life after his success as the author of Jarhead. We're talking especially about his relationship with his father, the journey to restore which was the subject of much of this book. You can join us by calling 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org. I want to start with a call that we've got here from Nathaniel in Baldwin City, Kansas. Nathaniel, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Great. Hi, Anthony.
Hi there.
I wanted to ask you, I am also a Marine. I served in Desert Storm, and I served leading up to it. And I wanted to comment, first of all, on a scene from the book. And I actually recall it more from the movie because it struck home, and that is the one with the platoon sergeant standing over punishing you, essentially, for your bad behavior the day before with the the reporters. I thought that was an incredibly accurate portrayal of Marines. But the second thing I wanted to say is my father was also a Vietnam vet, and we had a very difficult time in my 20s after I got out of the Marine Corps. And it has, I think, a less dark side in that he addressed issues, maybe not through therapy, but through his own techniques. And we have had the opportunity to patch things up and become good friends as we've gotten older. And I'm wondering, is that the gist of where you went with your father?
Yeah, you know, my father did this great thing. He did us both this wonderful service, and that was he had this massive Winnebago that he loved driving across the U.S., and he asked me to take a trip with him in 2009. We hadn't been in we'd been in discord for a number of years at that point. And I agreed to take this trip with him from Northern California to Billings. And it was his first attempt to reconcile and to have a very honest discussion about our relationship, about the past, and about moving forward. And that first trip didn't do the trick. It took two more trips, really. I write about three of the trips in the book. And they're intense moments. So, you know, two men in an RV driving across America. And I have to give my father a lot of credit because he was willing to have that discussion with me. When I told friends, hey, I'm about to jump in an RV with my father and drive 1,100 miles, they said, what, are you crazy? That sounds insane. And I thought it was insane at first. And in the end, I realized that those same friends, when I came back from these trips, they always said, you know, if their fathers had passed, I wish I'd had a chance to do that with my father. Or if their fathers were still alive, they'd say, maybe that's something that I can do with my dad, because maybe I need to be alone with him for a while in an RV or in a hotel room somewhere to just talk and to be two men with a past, with a history that may have some darkness, but that for the sake of everyone involved needs to find some healthy center. And that's what these RV trips with my father were all about.
Yeah. Nathaniel, does that find any resonance with your own experience?
Yes, I think that my father and I have the same issues that I'm hearing between Anthony and his father, and that is that there's a generational gap, too, that causes it to be difficult to communicate, especially between Vietnam veterans and veterans that are more recent. And so, yeah, we did it through working on house projects, you know, mm-hmm. carpentry, but it was the same process.
Working together. Nathaniel, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Nathaniel called us at 816-235-2888. And you're welcome to join the conversation, 235-2888. As prelude to those RV trips, Anthony Swofford, your father sent you a series of letters. They were written over several months that year. And he was taking issue with your memory of some events, some of which occurred in childhood, others as an adult, things that you'd written about in your first memoir, Jarhead, at least some of them. I guess I'm wondering how that functioned in your relationship and how that paved the way for you feeling the need to accept his offer to go on these road trips down the road.
Yeah, my father had some difficulty with my success, and I used kid gloves on him in Jarhead. Actually, I could have been a lot tougher on him.
Well, right. Some critics have pointed out there is a little disparity in the way he's portrayed in the two books.
There is. I don't think at the age of 30, when I started writing Jarhead, I was really ready to take my father on. But at the age of 38, when I started writing this new book, I had to. It was essential. It was essential to me moving on and becoming, you know, not just a son, but a father as well. You know, my father didn't like that I was airing dirty laundry. I was telling stories mm-hmm. about how he'd raised his children. And I think he was embarrassed by that. He couldn't really dispute the facts. He could dispute how I told the facts. You know, he was angry with me about an incident that had to do with summer camp. And, you know, I was a bit of a mama's boy, and I came home a week early from camp, and so my father had me repay him the cost of the second week of camp that I skipped out on. And he in this letter he's making sure that I understand that what he was trying to do was to teach me a very important lesson. And my question is, when you're 12 years old and you want to come home from camp early, what's the lesson there? Maybe you should just say, hey, my kid's home early. That's great. My father had sent me this letter. He'd sent my older brother a similar letter. And, when I received it, I picked up my mail one day here in Manhattan, and it was a thick letter. And I knew what it was. I knew it was this curse letter that was coming from my father, because he'd been I hadn't been returning his calls for a while, and he'd send me, he'd leave me kind of nasty voice messages and say, oh, I bet if I was a fancy Hollywood producer, you'd return my call, wouldn't you? And it's kind of goading me on, and I let those things drop. But this letter landed, and I knew what it was, because my brother had received the same kind of letter. I'd read that letter that my father had sent my brother after my brother died, and I knew what it contained. So I threw it in a desk drawer, and I didn't look at it. But after a few weeks, I cracked it open. And it was really a curse. It was an outline for my father of the many things that I'd done as a son and my many failures. And in the book, I use it as, it's sort of a call and response. I'm offering my rebuttal. And, I think you see that, my father is pretty crafty with language, too. And he knows how to smack me around with language, and I do a little of the same. So you see these two men in combat on the page, and then
that's an interesting
later
image.
In the book you see us in combat in the RV in a real kind of psychological tussle, and we're searching for some kind of truth and what it means. For me, what it means to be a son, what it means specifically to be this particular man's son. And something that I didn't point out that I should have already is, my father's also ill during these RV trips. He has chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder. So he's on oxygen and he's looking death in the face. He has been for about a decade now. And that's one of the ticking clocks of the book. Will these two men reconcile before it's too late?
I want to take a call from Sammy in Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Sammy. Sammy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Okay.
Good. Hey, excellent topic today. I'm just wondering, who reached out first? Was it you or your father? And if it was your father, why didn't you reach out first?
My father reached out first. He asked me to take that original RV trip with him from Northern California to Billings, Montana. And I didn't reach out first because, honestly, I was wounded. I was wounded by that letter. My father slapped me around a little in the letter, and he cursed me. There's a point where in the letter where he tells me that he spent time around people with money and that he will see me on my way down, is the exact quote. And I felt like I'd just been cursed by my father. And I'd been reading the memoirs of Elias Canetti at the time, and there's a moment in his memoirs where he talks about his father's father cursing his father, and then his father dying shortly after that. And it really shook me. I felt that I had been cursed by my father, and that's the very worst thing that a parent can do, is to curse a child. And I was having trouble seeing clearly, seeing a way out of that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call, Sammy. So you go on the first of these road trips with your father in 2009, from his home in California to a graduation in Montana, and your father reaches out to you and invites you. It says, "I think we need to get some things out in the open and clear the air. I think you need to get some venom out," he says. And how do you respond to that?
Well, I respond with some venom. I let him know that I'm angry with him, that I don't appreciate especially the way he lived his life around my brother's death, that I found it a cowardly act that brought shame upon the rest of the family.
Were you surprised that he opened the door so wide open for you to get that out?
I was surprised. I'm not sure that he realized the depth of my despair and my anger with him. I think in some ways my father thought that first trip we would have a mild talk. We would air our grievances. We would agree to disagree, as that's one of my father's sayings. We'll just agree to disagree. And I wasn't really willing to just agree to disagree. I felt like my father had slighted me when I was a kid. I felt like I knew that he had been verbally and physically abusive to me and my siblings. And that to just agree to disagree about the past would be too easy. And I needed him to take responsibility for how he'd acted. I was a young kid. I was a boy, and he was the man, and he was the one who was responsible for the kind of life that we lived. And I wasn't willing to just agree to disagree about the past and what it meant and what it could mean in the future.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. That's Anthony Swofford talking about his new memoir, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. So that was the first road trip you took with your father, and it left things, lots of things, unresolved. You go on another road trip with him in August of 2010, and by then your own life is got to be pretty close to what folks would say is rock bottom. You've gone broke. You've lost your apartment. What happens in this trip? Why make this trip when you did?
Well, I still didn't understand my father. I didn't understand why he'd blown our family up. You know, why he'd left my mother, and he was in the South. He was in Atlanta, and he was driving west. He asked me to take the trip with him back home from Atlanta. And I did, and we drove, you know, my father's sick, and we drove around these old West Georgia towns where there are Swoffords everywhere, and my father would stay in his RV and ask me to go out into the graveyards, these little church graveyards, and take photos, digital photos of all the Swofford gravestones, and he didn't even know if we were related to these people or who they were, but he was, you know, I call it the Dead Swoffords Tour, but I think he just wanted this idea of history and place. And I realized that was important to him. It was essential to him, and I also felt like on this road trip I could figure my father out, because I had hit rock bottom. I sold my fancy New York City apartment, and I was broke, and I sold it to scratch up some cash, and I was living in the Catskills in a little cabin on the side of the mountain, and I was alone, and I didn't want to be alone. I didn't want to live that way, and I thought if I could figure my father out, I might be able to figure my own way out of this. And we took this trip, and we kept going west, and one day I went for a run outside of I stayed in a hotel, and my father stayed in his RV west of Houston, and I went for this run, and I was really out of shape at this time. I wasn't living a healthy life, and I thought, I seriously thought I had a heart attack on the side of the road there, and some nice old lady in a powder blue Cadillac gave me a ride back to the hotel, and I'd been lying to my father. I told him that I had rented out my apartment to somebody and I was living in the mountains to get out of the city. And I told him that, you know, no, actually, Dad, I'm broke. You said you wanted to see me on my way down, and here I am, I'm down. And then I went outside and I floated in the pool. It was a baking hot August day. And I looked at my father in his RV, and I, you know, I loved the man. But I realized that I never wanted to be like him. He lived this sort of Clint Eastwood fantasy, the Western iconic wanderer, the man alone, and that was fine. He'd made those decisions, but I wasn't going to live that way. And for some years, I had been living like him, and I didn't make it all the way to California. I jumped on a plane home from Austin, and I got back to New York, and I just decided I was going to live my life differently. I was not going to abuse my body with substances. I was not going to lie and be unfaithful to lovers. And I was going to leave that past behind and leave that life behind, not be like my father. I call it a reverse midlife crisis. I'd already wrecked a sports car. I'd gone through women and money. And I wanted a station wagon and a family and a solid and grounded life.
A reverse midlife crisis.
A reverse midlife crisis, yeah.
816-235-2888 is the number to join our conversation. Paul is joining us from his car in Topeka. Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Paul,
good morning.
Paul, go ahead.
Yes, I'm 65 years old. I'm a Vietnam vet. I was in the Air Force. And much of what Anthony's saying is very close to me because I was the father. I've got a 44-year-old son, and the way, Anthony, you described your childhood is probably what I did to my son. I'm sure it is. So I'm trying now to – I'm in therapy for PTSD, and I'm trying to get my life where I want it to be. I'd like your input on how I might be able to best reach out to my son and we can be friends.
Well, it's a brave thing to attempt, and I as a son, I think your son would probably appreciate honesty and an honest, heartfelt apology and a theater where he can honestly air his grievances and feel like that he won't be judged for airing them, and that that what you want is a healthy relationship going forward, and that, you know, you're willing to put in that work. When my father showed me that he was, you know, willing to put in that work, that mattered a lot to me.
Good. Well, I appreciate that. He lives in New York now, so I have to wait until we can get together in person. I have talked to him on the phone, but I really want to get talk in person so we can relate to one another better. And I appreciate your input. I'm going to follow those guidelines and do my very best to be a friend to him.
Paul,
well, good luck, Paul.
Paul, I can't thank you enough for calling. Thank you. You talked with Paul there about needing to find an arena, a venue for telling the truth, for airing grievances. And it seems that in your story, Anthony Swofford, the venue is this Winnebago RV, as improbable as that may be, that
right.
you take these road trips with your father on. I wonder, actually, if we might ask you to read a little bit from the book about the third road trip, the last road trip you took with your dad. And this is on page 230, where you talk about why you needed this trip.
Yes. But I needed this trip. I wanted something. I wanted that reconciliation. I began to think of the RV as a truth machine, a narrative machine, like a photo booth but better, a story booth, the story of my father. And I realized that he too must feel this way. Story equals truth, and truth equals forgiveness. Driving along America's roads on each trip, we talked, and our mouths were spades, digging toward truth. He wanted me to forgive him, and he wanted to go back to the beginning of time. It was naive of me not to have recognized that part of my father's RV dream. His desire for constant motion was the wish to slow life down inside that machine, to stop time, to stop the decline of his health, to stop his aging, even to stop his own death and the death of his family.
That's Anthony Swofford reading from his memoir, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. You talk about reconciliation. Did you get that reconciliation?
We did. It took another trip, and it took me finally feeling as though I had gotten my venom out. And by this time, I was married, and my wife was 3 or 4 months pregnant, and my father and I were driving again from Northern California, but this time to Aspen, where I was about to spend some time around some injured veterans at a ski clinic. And, you know, we drove east, and we were once again at verbal combat over the past. But I think that my father and I both realized that a lot was at stake this time. He was sicker, of course. But also, I think he was finally able to let me go in a way as a son. It sounds kind of ludicrous, but, you know, I was 40 years old and I was finally about to be a father, and I needed to break away from just being a son to this man, and I needed to be a father. I needed to be a full man, and I had for, you know, many years thought about combat as the greatest test of manhood and the greatest test of my father. But this last trip, allowed me to be honest yet again. There was a blizzard up on the mountain, and I may have been a little too honest, and my father threatened to throw me out of the RV, and he was doing laps around the rodeo parking grounds at Snowmass Village, trying to kick me out of his RV in the middle of the night. And I just asked him to stop driving the vehicle. I'd been trying to sleep in the back, and I told him, I said, let's just move on, Dad. Let's finally, my venom is out. I love you, and I don't always agree. I can't always agree with the kind of father you'd been, but I do love you. And now I'm moving on. I'm going to be a father myself. And we finally, took three long trips and a lot of gas, but we finally got to that place of reconciliation and freedom.
We're almost out of time, Anthony. At the end of this book, your father is very ill, but he is alive. How is he now?
He's he's still around. He's still ill, moving slowly. But he's here. He has he's met my beautiful daughter, which is very important to me. When my daughter Josephine was 3 or 4 months old, we made the trip out, and he held my daughter in his hands, and he saw the future. He saw the past, his own past, our past. But I think mostly he saw the future and life moving on.
It's a powerful story. Anthony Swofford is the author of a new memoir, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks, Brian. Thank you very much.
You can find out more about Anthony Swofford and about all our guests at kcur.org. Don't forget you can follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Tomorrow, Steve Kraske's back for a look at the All-Star Game. Today's show was produced by Danny Alexander. Our show's senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.